Okay, everyone. I have gotten a quick preview of our speaker slides, and there is going to be a lot of real great information. So we will have some people dribbling in, but I'd like to get started now. My name is Joe Fiteschi. I am a member of the Cassini flight team here at JPL, and I would like to welcome you to the last telecon that we will be having prior to the end of mission, though not the last before the end of the project. I want to encourage everybody who's joining us now, a reminder, please mute your phones. Please, 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 as a consideration to everybody else, I promise you that if you have questions, you can unmute at that time and ask our speaker. In the meantime, it's really very important to us. And with that, I'd like to introduce today's speaker. Chris Glein is a research scientist at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, where he's a member of Cassini's ion and neutral mass spectrometer team. He received a bachelor's in chemistry from the University of Washington in 2006, 2 years after Cassini arrived at Saturn, and a PhD in geological sciences from Arizona State University in 2012. His graduate research focused on theoretical studies of geochemical processes on the Saturnian moons Enceladus and Titan, as well as the reactivity of organic acids in hydrothermal fluids via experiments. He did postdocs at the Geophysical Laboratory and the University of Toronto, where he gained additional expertise in high-pressure temperature experimentation and stable isotope geochemistry, respectively. He moved to SWRI in 2015. In addition to his work with Cassini, Chris is also a member of the Rosetta and Europa Clipper missions. His research interests include origins of volatile inventories on outer planetary bodies, compositions of alien oceans, and the habitability of outer planetary satellites, the latter two being fields that did not exist when he started college. Take it away, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Can everyone hear me okay?
I can.
Great, okay, and you can see my presentation, I'm assuming. Okay, good. Right, so I'm really happy to be giving this presentation today. Thank you all for tuning in. And today I'm going to tell you all about a recent discovery by the Cassini Project concerning Saturn's small but very active moon Enceladus and what that might mean for our understanding of whether this is an environment that could support life as we know it. So the main topic of this presentation is hydrogen, and you may have seen in the news about a month ago, we had a press conference and there were a bunch of articles written talking about hydrogen on Enceladus. And for some of you with an astronomy background, when you see the title hydrogen on another planet, you might have an inclination to be puzzled because hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, as shown by this table on the left-hand side. So it may not be surprising that we find hydrogen on another planet. The right-hand image is an early image returned from the Juno mission around Jupiter, and Jupiter is the largest repository of hydrogen gas, or H2, in the solar system. So it's common stuff to find in outer space, hydrogen is. Really, what is most interesting about finding hydrogen on a planet is when you find it on these so-called ocean worlds. So Earth is the example we're most familiar with, and if you look in the literature for how much hydrogen is on Earth, you can find that there's about half a part per million of H2 gas in Earth's atmosphere. So it's not very much compared to the nitrogen and oxygen in our atmosphere. And a major reason why you don't find hydrogen on these solid bodies, these ocean worlds, is because it's a very light gas, so it's prone to escape from smaller bodies. You need huge bodies like Jupiter to hang on to the hydrogen. But there are some intriguing environments on ocean worlds where hydrogen is found in great abundance. So these, of course, are the hydrothermal vent systems that are found on the bottom of the Earth's oceans. And what happens is reactions between hot water and rock produces abundant hydrogen, and recent estimates tabulate about 1 million metric tons of hydrogen gas being produced every year on the Earth. And it's particularly important for establishing a connection between the chemistry of a planet and the ability of a planet to support life. So on the left-hand image here, I know there's a lot of lines, but these lines each correspond to different hydrothermal systems on the Earth. They have names like Rainbow or Lau. And what I'm plotting here, these numbers show how much energy is available from this reaction I'm highlighting here, which is known as methanogenesis. It's using hydrogen gas to form methane. And you can see at lower temperatures where this hydrothermal fluid that's rich in hydrogen mixes with seawater, abundant energy is made available. And the consequences are dramatic. So in the late 1970s, scientists first sent submarines down near these hydrothermal vent sites, and they discovered that there are teeming communities of microorganisms and then larger ecosystems that feed on those microorganisms. So there's basically the foundation of these systems that are in complete darkness is chemical energy provided by the planet. So we're very excited about these types of ideas and how they might apply to other ocean worlds in the outer solar system where we think there's abundant liquid water, possibly in contact with rocks. And this is where the recent information from Enceladus is continuing to accumulate and whetting our appetites. So in 2015, there was a study from the Cassini Cosmic Dust Analyzer team, and they reported finding silica particles. This is like small grains of beach sand that were found in outer space around the Saturn environment. And what these scientists did is they traced these particles back to Enceladus, and that they found that the only way that these particles could be produced in such great abundance is if there are environments deep in Enceladus where hot fluids that are rich in dissolved minerals like the silicon mix with cold ocean water and form these small particles at the seafloor environment, which are eventually erupted out of Enceladus's plume. So that's the evidence, that was the early evidence for hydrothermal environments on Enceladus. Then on the right hand side here is a figure from a recent paper I also had in 2015, where I tried to combine the Cassini CDA data, so this is the dust data, with the ion and neutral mass spectrometer measurements of CO2 in the plume gas. And you can see that there's this region where you kind of intersect both constraints that is shaded blue. And that's where you get self-consistency between the two data sets. And we found that that self-consistency is achieved when the source region, the ocean of Enceladus, has a high pH. So this is how acidic that water is. On Earth, our seawater has a pH of about 8. And on Enceladus, it looks like it's above about 11 to 12. So it's what we call an alkaline ocean, sort of like a solution of Windex is an alkaline solution. So putting these two pieces of evidence together, we think we have evidence for hydrothermal, and then a process that produces this high pH is called serpentinization. And you're probably wondering, well, what the heck is that? Well, it's a geochemical process, and it's called serpentinization because when certain rocks called ultramafic rocks, so they contain these types of minerals like called olivines and pyroxenes, react with water, they make this new mineral called serpentine. And it's kind of got a bad rap because it's also one of the components in asbestos. The reason it's called serpentinization is the mineral that's produced in these geological environments is green colored. And it's also a California state rock, which could be of interest for those of you on the West Coast. And it looks like it's a dominant process whenever rocks interact with water in the solar system. So people who go to the Antarctic and collect meteorites find that when they analyze these space rocks using geochemical techniques, they find evidence of small grains of this serpentine. So it looks like it's a dominant process throughout the solar system. And it inevitably leads to a high pH because these rocks are rich in elements like magnesium and calcium and iron. It's not too common at the surface of the Earth where humans interact, because most of these rocks that are really potent precursors of serpentinization are actually in the Earth's mantle. But there are some certain areas where these types of rocks are exposed at seafloor. And probably the most famous example is called the Lost City Hydrothermal Vent Field. This is a vent field that was discovered about almost 20 years ago now in the Mid-Atlantic Ocean. And it has some very unusual properties. So on this table here, I'm basically showing you the physical properties. The temperature is not hot like the Black Smoker hydrothermal vents, but it's sort of warm. It would be pretty warm to us, but to a microbe, it's not too bad. 90 degrees Celsius. It has a pH, so this measure of the acidity, that is similar to the derived pH of the Enceladus Ocean, about 9 to 11. And notice I've highlighted in bold here the hydrogen abundance. So these are some of the most hydrogen-enriched natural environments on the planet. And so the concentration here is written as M, capital M. This is 10 millimolar. And so you don't really find environments on the Earth that have much more hydrogen than these Lost City vent fluids. This stuff, when people bring it to the surface, there's so much hydrogen, the fluid will be bubbling out hydrogen. And so this is basically where we were in late 2015. This is kind of the model that we were left with, is we think that there are serpentinization and hydrothermal processes. And if you put it together, this is the picture that emerged, where there could be some kind of high temperature zones inside of a rocky core on Enceladus, shown here. The rock might react with hot water to make hydrogen, and that hydrogen might eventually be outgassed into this plume here. This is all, of course, very interesting to folks like myself, but notice that hydrogen is shown at the bottom here, and at that time in 2015, we had not actually found the hydrogen yet, so it was the key missing piece to this puzzle. So this leads us to October of 2015, one of the very last close flybys of Enceladus that were devoted to looking at the chemistry of the plume on Enceladus. And a chief objective of this flyby was to perform the most sensitive search yet for the presence of H2 or hydrogen in the plume. It was performed at a closest approach distance of less than 50 kilometers from the surface. And this is just basically, if you're not aware of what we think is happening on Enceladus, this is a nice summary from a paper in 2014, basically showing what we think. There's an ocean in contact with a rocky interior, and then this ocean is traveling through a series of plumbing and eventually erupted into outer space. So ocean water is erupting into space along with the gases dissolved in that water. And here's some of the primary data. So this is, we were very excited when we got this data about a week after the flyby, because it was very intriguing. So on the top panel shows these different masses that our instrument measures. So mass 2 corresponds to hydrogen or H2. Mass 18 is water. Mass 28 could be carbon monoxide or nitrogen gas. They have the same mass. And mass 44 was CO2. On the top panel here, you can kind of see that as you get to zero time of closest approach, that's like right when you're in the plume, we see the largest signals detected. And that was the old data. So we kind of had a sense of, okay, there's water in the plume, there's some CO2 and so forth. The new data, we're using this new mode called open source mode. And what open source mode does is it eliminates any sort of possibility that you could have chemistry happening inside the instrument before the molecules are being measured by the instrument. And so that's useful, because in closed source mode, there's questions of whether the hydrogen that we detect could somehow be produced inside the instrument as an artifact. But in open source mode, the molecules just fly straight back into the detector where they're counted. And here's a zoom in of the open source data. And you can see here in red, we did hydrogen counts. Some of the largest counts are about 100 to 200 counts. So use this new mode of using the instrument, and we found hydrogen in the plume. So this is very exciting, of course. Then what we did is we engaged in a very detailed analysis of these data to try to understand, okay, well, how much hydrogen could there be in the plume? And what we had to do is we had to construct a model of how the plume erupts gases and how they are received by the spacecraft instrument. So I won't get into too many details here other than you can see in this bottom panel, these are all the individual geysers that are providing gases to the plume. So we had to account for all of their inputs into the plume. And the top panel basically shows all the different directions at which the gases could be received by the spacecraft. So it was a difficult problem to try to understand the detailed geometry of the system. This is the results of our modeling shown here. So you can see in the top panel, this is our attempt to reproduce the water signal. So we can produce parts of it using our model, but other parts appear to be different, which might indicate that the sources of water change over the course of different flybys. And then the bottom panel, perhaps the most interesting part of this presentation, is the modeling of how much hydrogen is contained in the plume. So we tried two different models, one called isotropic and one called collisionless. I won't get into too many details here, but we found that the isotropic is a more consistent model in terms of the physical conditions of the plume. And from that model, we were able to derive a best fit from the model to the data if the plume contains about 1% hydrogen gas relative to water. So that was a key number from all this analysis. It was about 1% hydrogen content of the plume of Enceladus. Okay, so then the next part, that was the data part. And then there was this whole other part of this project where once we convinced ourselves that we understood how much hydrogen is in the plume, we decided to ask ourselves, well, hold on a second. Is hydrogen necessarily mean that it has to be hydrothermal, or could there be other ways for a planet like, or a moon, I should say, like Enceladus, to acquire hydrogen? So that's what we looked into. And this table here basically summarizes, I won't go into every single argument, but we looked at a variety of possible ways that Enceladus could acquire hydrogen. So one example shown here in the second row is you could imagine that Enceladus's building blocks might have looked something like comets. And if those building blocks formed at very low temperatures, less than 20 degrees Kelvin, hydrogen gas could have been trapped in the building blocks of the moon. However, when we look at the data from Enceladus, you would expect from this type of model that if those cold temperatures prevailed when Enceladus formed, that in addition to hydrogen gas, Enceladus should have things like argon or neon or Cl. So these are other gases that are trapped in ice at very low temperature, and we didn't see those in the plume. So basically, what this slide summarizes is these different ways that we could imagine a moon like Enceladus making hydrogen. So this is the homegrown variety, or getting hydrogen when it first formed. And the second column here basically shows how we analyze the data and the different inconsistencies. So these are things that don't add up if these were the sources of the hydrogen. You'd expect, so for example, if you had homegrown hydrogen from radiation processing ice on Enceladus' surface, water molecules would be converted to hydrogen and oxygen. We don't see the oxygen gas, so we conclude that this is not a very viable possibility. And for all four of these possibilities, we basically use that same very meticulous accounting and analysis to reject these possibilities. This will get into a little more of the chemistry, but I'll just kind of try to go through this at a very high level to help you understand what we think might be going on with making hydrogen. And so the fundamental idea here is that hydrogen on these types of ocean worlds is produced from water. The water has hydrogen atoms, but you need to convert hydrogen atoms to H2 molecules, so the oxygen atom needs to be dispensed. And the way that happens is in these hydrothermal environments is the oxygen atom gets bound up to iron. And when that happens, the hydrogen is released as free hydrogen. So you can basically see in these different equations, so let's take B for example, the iron binds up a lot of oxygen here, and so you're left with free H2 that's produced. So we basically constructed a model where we could account for how much iron we think could be inside of Enceladus. And from that amount of iron, we could use these equations, these chemical equations, to calculate, okay, well, how much hydrogen could you get out of that? And so this basically summarizes the overall physical situation where you have an ocean on Enceladus, but below that ocean is a lot of rock with a lot of iron. The fundamental result is nicely understood with this particular example. So if you were to imagine that 1% out of that chunk of rock in Enceladus's core is reacting to produce the hydrogen that we see in the plume, you could sustain that process for about 500 million years. So there's a lot of potential to keep making hydrogen for quite a long time. So we call that geochemistry. This appears to be a robust process. It doesn't appear to require anything particularly special. I'll show you all a few comparisons to the Earth, because the Earth is something we think we understand, and it's nice to use that as a point of reference. So hydrogen is found in both Lost City and in the plume, but so is methane. And when you look at the hydrogen to methane ratio in these environments, it's kind of interesting. So at Lost City, the ratio is about 9. And in the Enceladus plume, we have larger error bars, but it's around 1 to 14, which nicely is consistent with that range of 9 that we find at Lost City. So it looks like that part of the story checks out as well. If you haven't had the chance to see this image yet, I'd encourage you to find it. You can find it on the NASA PhotoJournal website. I think the Cassini website has it as well. This is an image that we produced for this press event with NASA, and it was produced by an artist with the LA Times, and I really like it. I think he did a great job. And I actually made a big poster for my daughter, and so she really likes that. And I'm sure young children would like this as well for other families. Here's kind of an overall comparison of Enceladus to the Earth. So notice Earth really tips the scales, huh? Here's the production rate of hydrogen on the Earth is about 10 to the 12th moles per year. And Enceladus is about 1,000 times less. Which perhaps that's not too surprising, because Enceladus is a lot smaller than our planet, so there's not as the hydrothermal activity on Enceladus is just not as widespread on a whole global basis as we find on the Earth. Okay, so I'll have a few slides here basically explaining why we think this is so exciting. So there's many applications of hydrogen towards astrobiology and thinking about the potential for life on Enceladus. And the key concept is that H2 is produced from the rocks, and it links this inorganic chemistry of rocks and iron and water to the organic chemistry of complex molecules. So basically I'm showing this simple schematic equation where if you have CO2 reacting with hydrogen, you can make organic molecules. So a type of organic molecules is something like a hydrocarbon. So to make a hydrocarbon, you have to add hydrogen to carbon. And this shows some of our data from earlier on in the Cassini mission. And at higher masses, where I'm circling here, these are different organic species like benzene or butane and simple types of organic molecules. So the finding of hydrogen might help us understand how these molecules are being produced inside Enceladus, whether it be from life processes, if there's organisms on Enceladus, or it could be geochemical processes. Finding of hydrogen is also very relevant for understanding the potential for the origin of life on Enceladus. For those of you who aren't familiar, one of the emerging models for how life might have originated on our planet is hydrothermal systems looking something like Lost City, where you have simple molecules like hydrogen, CO2, and hydrogen sulfide undergoing complex chemistry with different minerals to form more complex organic molecules. So this is very exciting for a potential connection between these early environments on Earth that could have led to the origin of life and thinking about the possibility of life starting on Enceladus. And probably what's greatest interest is potential for current life on Enceladus using hydrogen as a fuel. You may have heard of the hydrogen economy. Hydrogen is a fantastic fuel. And so I was warned that this could be a little bit of a daunting figure. So I'm going to walk everyone through this, and we're just going to go over the general ideas here. But the idea when we have a hydrogen measurement is we can now calculate how much energy is available if there was life present. And so I called this earlier on during the press conference, we've made the first calorie count of an alien ocean, because it's really true. We're counting how much energy there could be to support life. So let's look at how this is done. One equation that I won't discuss any of the details other than this equation tells you how much energy is available. That's this quantity delta G. And there's two parts of it. One part is theory. So we don't need to go anywhere. We can use a computer to calculate this first part. It's just based on theory. The second part of this equation, though, we need measurements of CO2, hydrogen, and methane. And the great thing about Cassini is Cassini allowed us to make these measurements of these types of molecules at Enceladus. And notice I've drawn this line here, this line at zero. So if you have zero energy, that's called chemical equilibrium, and that would be a state of death for any forms of life, including us. And so from various studies of organisms on Earth, these green lines basically show how much energy is needed by life. What is the demand that life imposes on geology to continue, to sustain life? So we know it's about 10 to 20 in these units of affinity. Then using the Cassini data, we were able to quantify, well, how much energy is available in this Enceladus ocean plume system. And that amount depends on the pH of the water, which we've estimated to be between about 9 and 11. So somewhere between these two curves is where Enceladus lies. And then with the hydrogen measurement, we're able to bracket it further between these two gray lines. So this, again, we have the sweet spot of where the data are leading us. And it turns out the data are leading us to a bonanza of energy being available. And so to answer this question, is there enough chemical energy to support life as we know it? The answer is yes. So maybe these hydrothermal vents are actually producing a feast if there's anything around to eat it. The supply of energy is greater than the types of demands that organisms that we can study have. So the conclusion is that Enceladus is energetically habitable. There's enough energy to sustain life. And so you might have heard of the three essential requirements that astrobiologists think about to support life. So what's required to make an environment habitable? Previously, Cassini has found abundant evidence for liquid water, so we can check that off our list. We found many of the essential elements like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. We haven't quite found all of the needed elements, so we got kind of like a partial check mark there. And now with this new discovery, we found that there's an abundant source of free energy in this environment that life could exploit. So if there was an Earth microbe in that ocean, it would be perfectly happy. Of course, the next natural question is whether, now that we have a sense of the environment looking like it's very promising in terms of being habitable, we want to understand, could it be inhabited? And that's going to be a $1 billion question for the future. And so this is a slide that basically summarizes this progression between geochemistry and ecology. I won't get into all the details other than there are very intriguing parallels between how the earliest geochemistry on planets processes hydrogen to make organic molecules such as methane, and the biochemistry of the most primitive forms of life that we find on Earth, like around these hydrothermal systems, that process hydrogen in a very similar way to make organic molecules and to get energy to sustain these ecosystems. So Enceladus offers us, I think, a fantastic opportunity to try to test these types of ideas of whether the drive from geochemistry to biochemistry to ecology, is that inevitable on wet, rocky planets, or is it a very rare occurrence? We don't know the answer, and I think this is an environment that can help provide critical clues to this question. You might ask, well, what's NASA doing now that Cassini is nearing the end and we don't have any more data flowing from Enceladus? Well, we're interested in a lot of different things. We have the Europa Clipper that has a very similar but much more advanced payload than Cassini. We have these mass spectrometers that are able to measure hydrogen and other different molecules that could serve as food sources. There's a variety of different proposals for the next New Frontiers call. So these are NASA's medium-class missions to look for evidence of life on Enceladus. And, of course, there's the very intriguing but also somewhat contentious Europa lander that would directly search for signs of life on the surface of Europa. So we're thinking about all of these ocean worlds and trying to understand how we can use the type of method that we've developed from Cassini to take the next step. And so with that, I'll leave you all with this conclusion slide, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Chris, thank you. That was just wonderful. You've got a room full of scientists and engineers sitting here at JPL who are sitting here with big grins on their faces, and it's not just because we see a giant squid poking its head out over Enceladus. I want to open up the telecon for questions. Who out there has something to ask our speaker?
I do.
We have one, Michael Stab, who is our favorite ace, who is not on council right now because we're not driving, well, second favorite because Dave Duty's also in the room.
Well, and all our systems are down still. I was asking Trina, the reason you said that you haven't seen the phosphorus and the sulfur yet, is that because the phosphate and the sulfate, those most likely salts that are in the ocean, is it because it's outside the bounds of the mass spec?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the ion and neutral mass spectrometer measures neutral volatile species, so we can't see the salts. The other instrument, the Cassini Cosmic Dust Analyzer, could see the salts, but the instrument really isn't optimized to look for sulfate and phosphate. And the reason for that is that instrument was designed to detect positively charged species. So that's how it found the sodium plus ions in the plume particles, but it's not sensitive at all for looking at especially trace species like phosphate.
Well, I have a question, and this is only half formed because this morning I saw a preprint talking about detection of oxygen molecules in the spectra of exoplanets, and a question about what that might mean for habitability. So it might be a different issue when you're looking perhaps at a water plume, but how do you distinguish between oxygen molecule? Well, how would you distinguish a situation between oxygen molecules as signature of biological activity as a byproduct of something which is more geochemistry?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to address, especially when you have such little data like you do from the exoplanets. Oxygen is also similarly problematic like hydrogen is, because there's a lot of oxygen in the universe, so there's potentially a lot of different ways for planets to make oxygen molecules by just geochemical means. So a classic example is if you shine UV light on a mixture of water vapor, oxygen gas can be produced. So I think that the most sensible first strategy is to try to look for explosive mixtures. And I'm only saying that somewhat jokingly. So if you find mixtures that are unhappy, they're thermodynamically unstable with respect to each other, that's the first sign. And then we really need to do a lot of work. So you can see by this project we presented, you have to really try to understand what the full scope of abiotic geochemistry is capable of before you start to consider biology. So this is what Carl Sagan used to say, that biology is a hypothesis of last resort, and I think that's really true.
We've received a couple of questions on the chat side, and first of all from Ocean McIntyre, who's one of our Solar System Ambassadors, asking, is there a hypothesis as to the process that is causing the hydrothermal vents and how long it has been occurring?
There's a hypothesis, but we don't really know much about it yet. So we think when Enceladus' activity was first discovered, it was found that we had an unsettling energy crisis where there was too much energy being released by all the heat release in the geologically active zone and these plumes. And some progress has been made towards understanding how you could have energy generated. So this would be the process of tidal heating. But to get hot rock, there needs to be tidal heating in this rock. And that's not something that's very well understood yet. Previous modeling had suggested that the rock might be too rigid. So it would not flex and generate viscous heating very efficiently. But some recent work has suggested if the rock is mixed in with liquid water, then its properties could be much more amenable to tidal processes. And there's been some recent abstracts and conference presentations performing some models looking into this process, but this is not very well understood right now. So we think the observations are telling us that this is probably happening, but now it's up to the geophysicist people to try to understand the details of how this could really work. And also then to, you know, address, is this going to be a very transient, ephemeral process, or could it be something that's been taking place for tens or hundreds of millions of years? That's going to have tremendous implications for thinking about the temporal component of habitability, or if there could have been enough time for life to originate in Enceladus' ocean.
Another question that has come in from Paco Foss Science Center asking, is there any way to estimate how long these processes have been going on? And that, I believe you talked about a half-billion-year limit about how much material, I'm guessing, could be. But could you expand on that some more?
Yeah, the short answer is I don't think it's possible right now. You could certainly take my calculation and run with it and simply extrapolate the present situation into the past. And that could suggest that this process has been happening for the history of the solar system, but we should be very cautious because we don't actually following up on the previous question, we don't understand the geophysics of the deep system well enough to understand if that's reasonable or completely off base to assume that the present is the key to the past for this particular system.
Had a couple of questions come in asking about future instrumentation, and I'm just going to bundle these together. First of all, from Adriana Provenzano asks, what scientific instruments are being developed to study the hydrothermal vents on Earth that may be used on Enceladus? And then also in that same wheelhouse, from Jonathan Ward, what kind of instrument would be needed on a Life Finder flyby craft in order to prove that there was a biological organism present? Sort of imaging a critter directly, how else do you prove there's life there?
Right, all very good questions. So it's hard to figure out a universal instrument to determine the presence of life or to understand how these systems are happening in detail. People on the Earth are talking about testing mass spectrometers at hydrothermal vents. So presently what people do is they collect samples from their submarines and then bring them to the laboratory, which is great, but that's not actually what we're going to do if we were to ever send a lander or a submarine to the bottom of Enceladus' ocean. We would be performing the measurements in situ, so there's a lot of interest in trying to test these technologies in environments that we think we understand. Regarding trying to find evidence of life, that's a really tough one. There's been proposals to take imagers to look for things moving like was suggested. That's not actually a joke. People are thinking about that. And there's also various measurements that are looking for particular molecules like we find in Earth-like life, like DNA or amino acids. So there's always this tricky question of, do you want to send an instrument that can perform a general survey of all the different types of organic compounds that are present, or do you want to try to design a silver bullet to look for one very specific class of molecules? The danger in looking just for DNA, as an example, is we don't know if life on Enceladus that may have originated separately from life on Earth, if that form of life would use DNA, it may very well use some other type of molecule to store its genetic information. So there's always this tug of war of how far do you want to go between being a generalist and being very specific. And those debates are still being made as the next generation of missions are being designed. And it will be particularly interesting to see what NASA chooses to emphasize.
I know that the descriptions that have been going on about the mission concept for the Europa lander, people are really struggling with a lot of these issues as well.
Yeah, so, you know, we have to try to keep debating and do our best. At the end of the day, though, these are such complex environments, I think we're just going to be completely blown away by the complexity and how spectacular they will be.
Had a question from Sally Jensen asking about the role of nitrogen in all of this.
Yeah, nitrogen, well, we see in the plume, we see evidence of ammonia. And that sort of makes sense because ammonia is stable in the presence of hydrogen. So both of those molecules are what's known to chemists as reduced molecules. That makes sense, but we don't really know what happens to the nitrogen from ammonia. So it's tempting to think, well, could some of that nitrogen be incorporated into things like amino acids or even more complex nitrogen molecules? But those are particularly difficult analytical challenges to try to detect those types of molecules. Even a simple amino acid is not easy to find because they're not terribly abundant like the simplest molecules like hydrogen, ammonia, and CO2. So that's going to be a question for the next stage of exploration.
Right. Had a question come in from Richard Stember. By the way, for those of you online, you are welcome to ask questions yourself. Of course, if you send them in by chat, that's fine as well. Do you see a future role for measuring isotopic fractionization of carbon in differentiating between biotic and abiotic sources?
Absolutely. That's one of the standard parts of our arsenal for looking at anomalies that we might attribute to the presence of life. So to explain to the rest of the general audience, many environments on the Earth where organisms make methane from CO2, they preferentially make the lighter version of methane because it costs less energy to do that. So it's possible that we could see similar effects on Enceladus, where if we saw some preference towards making isotopically light methane that looks like it's much different from anything we would recognize as geochemistry, then that might be a first piece of evidence to suggest the presence of life. But it's nowhere conclusive, so that would be one part of the toolkit. And then we want to bring multiple layers of evidence to really try to constrain, does this really test for the presence of life?
We've had a question come in from Jack Howard asking, this is something you've touched on a little bit about how we would be looking for life if we are just flying by, but if we don't land on Europa or Enceladus, and some of our missions will only be flybys, what methodology will allow us to detect any life forms that might exist in the subsurface oceans? That's going to be possibly especially challenging for Europa, where there is split expert opinion on whether or not we have truly seen plumes coming off or not.
Right. It's a tough problem. I think the starting point is to look at the molecules. I'm a geochemist. I like to tell people that the message is in the molecules. There's a story in the molecules. The collection of molecules tells a story. I mean, it's kind of like if you go to Yosemite in the United States and you look at a granite outcrop. Those minerals in those rocks tell a story of what happened there. Some event happened in the past or is happening today. And I think it's a similar type of story on Enceladus, where the plume contains a message. It's a collection of molecules, and it's going to require all of our ingenuity to try to interpret what this is telling us. So for looking for life, we want to look for what particular molecules are there, what are their abundances with respect to one another, and how does that compare to different environments on the Earth or outside of the Earth? So does the mixture of molecules look like a frozen comet that's been melted, or does it look like a hydrothermal vent, or might it look like an environment where life has provided a large imprint on the chemistry? I think that's the real challenge. Of course, the difficulty is in the details to try to identify what are the key signatures that we don't think geochemistry can do.
This past weekend was the JPL Ticket to Explore, when we have about 18,000 people coming each day to go through and take a look at what the lab has to offer. And several people were asking the Cassini folks about what we know about the composition of Enceladus' ocean, let alone Titan's. And my answer was that we can't entirely sample it. We don't really know enough about the detailed composition because we did not take our beach gear along with us when we flew out to Saturn. And so what you say about the molecules containing the story rings so true for us.
Yeah, kind of the bulk properties. I hope no one goes too wild here, but you could make Enceladus' ocean in the kitchen in its basic properties. So it looks just like a mixture of table salt, that sodium chloride, a little bit of sodium bicarbonate, and then a little bit of sodium carbonate. So these last two things, bicarbonate is baking soda, and then sodium carbonate is known as washing soda. So if you put a little bit of baking soda in an oven and cook it, you can make washing soda, and then you're set. And I've made this for kids in science fairs before. I've personally tasted the stuff, and it sort of tastes like salt water. It doesn't kill you, but I would encourage people here not to taste it.
I had another question come in asking from Ocean McIntyre, asking, will any future instrumentation be looking at chirality as a key to life detection?
I think probably some of the missions that have been proposed or are currently being proposed are looking at chirality. So this is certain molecules that have bonding arrangements of different groups around carbon atoms in organic molecules exhibit what are known as left-handed and right-handed forms. They're mirror images. And it turns out that for reasons that are not really understood, life on Earth chooses to make one particular mirror image of a certain molecule, like an amino acid. And if you compare that to geochemistry doesn't appear to show that type of preference. So this is a particularly strong tool in our arsenal towards testing for the presence of life.
Kay, I'd like to thank our speaker once again. That was just outstanding. It really gave a very great sense about the work you've been doing. You know how long you've been waiting to release this result. We're delighted to have you here. And a reminder to everybody else who's listening in, this will be our last charm until after September 15th, which will mark the end of the mission, but not the end of the project. And I expect that we will be resuming the charm telecons sometime after we will see you on the other side. Thank you, as always, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you here, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.